That song is Taj Mahal by Queen Bee. We can only play 30 seconds of it per show, since we don't have copyright permissions. But that is our theme song. And if you want to hear more, look up Taj Mahal Queen Bee. That's a great song for us to celebrate this very beautiful day. And what really feels like to me like a reawakening of the beehives. I'm a skeptic. Let's put it out there. I'm not one of those people that's convinced by other people's spiritual experiences. I'm one of those, scientifically based education systems that really wants proof, before you have documented your spiritual experience, which is, of course, not necessarily part of a spiritual experience. Spiritual experiences are kind of undocumentable. They're personal and experiential and based on individuals' awareness and acceptance of what they're experiencing. So with that as my background, I will say I had something of an interesting experience a while ago where I had this sensation that was this full body sensation of the bees coming alive in the apiary. And by coming alive, I just mean maybe a decision being made to begin the good work of prepping for spring. And it felt like this, it felt the same in my body as before I go surfing. Like when I'm standing on the coast looking at the waves coming in and I've got my board and my wetsuit and I'm checking out the scene to see what's going to happen. And I get this vibrational charge in my body when I'm getting ready to surf or snowboard, for example. And I had that same sensation, but associated with it was this consciousness of we're waking up. And that's how I heard it and felt it. And what was really interesting about that is I put a little Facebook post up there and a few other people commented that they were feeling the exact same thing. So that's one of those synchronicities that is kind of creates belief in your spiritual experience. When you have synchronicity around an experience like that, it kind of authenticates it or just gives it a little bit of extra oomph of possible truth in there. So, I do spend every day thinking about the bees and bee consciousness and how to communicate with them and how to spread the word of the environmental needs and discoveries that the bees are bringing us. And so maybe my spiritual experience is that sixth sense, that after honing in on five senses, I'm not saying I'm any kind of, monk or guru or anything. Like, I'm not any more practicing of the sacred beekeeping than any other person who identifies with that. But, this sort of gives me, maybe this is my practice, my daily practice of thinking about the bees and practicing being with the bees. Maybe that does offer my subconscious and superconsciousness a little extra chain reaction that I can have these experiences and feel possibly that they are authenticated. And I would authenticate that by going out into the apiary and seeing if indeed that was true. And guess what, everybody? It's true. The bees are waking up. They are bringing in fat pollen coins. They are buzzing right now in the sun, singing the love song to the world of, yes, it is returning. The season of fruition is coming again, and the sun is returning to our land, and much work is to be done facilitating the love affair between earth and sky, facilitating the relationship between blossoms in the field, and facilitating the fruiting, hormonal, gorgeous, sumptuous presence of blossoms to fruit, and the bees help with that, and they sing the whole time, just as they've been singing for 200 million years. The song of creation, the same sound you hear in the beehive is the sound that you hear if we were alive 200 million years ago when the first flowers and fruit and came about, and when the first bee came about, the first vegetarian insect on the planet. And how wonderful is that? So on the note of discoveries and brilliance and exceptional connections being made out in the world today, I was made aware of Paul Stamets' work on the Bee and the Mushroom. Now, I have been notified about that some time ago when this information first started coming out. And interestingly enough, before I started on my journey of the Sacred Beekeeper and the development of the College of the Melissa, Center for Sacred Beekeeping, located here in Ashland and worldwide, before I started doing that, I was living in the Pacific Northwest. I know Ashland is considered part of the Pacific Northwest, but I would barely consider it in that designation. To me, it's California. The Pacific Northwest, to me, is marked by these deep deep rainforests and mountainous streams and really green, mossy, fungus-laden coastal environments. But, you know, I lived 20 years up there in Port Townsend, Washington, and really got a sense of the maritime Pacific Northwest, which is maybe where I'm talking about when I say the real Pacific Northwest. But regardless of my perspective, Paul Stamets is located up there in the Olympic Rainforest in my home region, and I was made aware of him many, many years ago when his medicinal mushrooms started appearing in our local shops, and people started asking me all the way back then if there was a connection between mushrooms and bees, and one of the first-year students of the College of Melissa, Melissa Tyler Hawkins, started experimenting with providing honey jun made with mushroom blends. The honey tastes kind of funky, but I am assuming that would be great for savory dishes as opposed to our little sweet treats that we like to do with honey. And it is kind of a like a funky sort of bread-ish type honey that comes from that hive. And it kind of startles us when we taste it, because sometimes the hives that get this funky taste in honey actually were robbing the one that was fed with this. So it's just interesting. Anyway, so we've been experimenting through the college with this honey jun probiotic substance. And I also am reminded that one of my friends, Aaron Rain, who has an incredible, I have yet to see it, but from the stories I've heard of this apiary, he has an apiary with 20 hives that have a less than 10% loss per year. And he is located in an isolated region along the Oregon coast. And how fascinating that he's only experiencing a 10% loss of beehives, and he has longevity in his hives, sometimes as long as 10 years, which is the natural order of the bee life cycle. And he doesn't do interventions and feedings, to my knowledge, but guess what he does have in his environment? A whole, oh, I almost swore, a whole bunch of mushroom mat growing in the forest there. So the reason why I'm bringing this issue up today is because I have received, and I am not kidding, around 20 emails about this guy. And I'm just fascinated with what he's saying, because he has a TED Talk, and it's about how mushrooms can save the honeybee. What I really love about this guy is he seems like his perspective is a lot like the College of the Melissa's perspective, in that he really looks at this mushroom and forest from a deeply, from a deep perspective that includes not only his own passion and love affair with the planet and his embodied wisdom gathering that he's doing as probably one of the world's leading, if not the world's leading, you know, mushroom and especially mushroom bee expert. This guy is recognized in scientific circles. He's part of the Bioneer movement, which is huge, and he also is recognized by additional scientific researchers, which is great, because here's an out-of-the-box thinker who believes, as I do, in citizen science initiative, citizens coming together and promoting scientific discoveries, such as his research on mushrooms. his awareness about mushrooms and the interactions that, and the fact that bees even like mushrooms, he was made aware of this because he had some mushrooms growing in his garden, because he's a gardener of many things, including bees and flowers and vegetables and whatnot, and mushrooms. So he saw that for 40 days straight, the bees were sucking the accumulated sweat or evaporation, what is that called? Aspiration, perspiration, I don't know, the droplets that are forming on these mushrooms. And for 40 days, these bees accessed these mushrooms by moving very large wood chips, which would be done very vigorously, probably by several bees, when you saw what they did on his little video. And they drank from these mushrooms for 40 days. First of all, how cool is that number, 40 days? How many times have we heard that being associated with a spiritual journeying of 40 days? I'm not saying there's a connection. I just think that's a cool number. And I like to make associations with the bee for all kinds of reasons. And I find that these things sometimes have metaphors in them. So I'm just mentioning that as a potential metaphor. But the important thing is the bees excavated this fungal mat and drank it up. And around the same time, as synchronicities are wont to do, Paul Stamets was reading some information about fungus and fungicidal applications and how the two interchange to affect bee health. So what he's proposing is that the largest organism on earth is this wonderful mushroom that forms 1 centimeter or 1 cell or something thick across huge expansions of land and is fed by the canopy debris of healthy forests. And what this fungus does is it transforms different minerals and amino acids and nutrients in the soil, breaks down the rot, digests it, and provides a host of qualities to the forest. Now, what I mean by a host of qualities is, you know, the scientists in us automatically, and the science culture in us automatically wants to know what are the scientific offerings. They're measurable, they are definable, and they're something that we can test, right? So here it is. This feeds nutrients through the soil when you have this sort of system of this huge organism of this fungus, and it ends up breaking down things and feeding the soil and providing nutrients to other plants' root network. And these mats of this particular fungus spread across this huge area. And just like Fern Gully and what's that other movie with the flying dragony things? Avatar, you know, how the forest communicates. They illuminate that through those special effects, how the forest can communicate through this root network. What a great way of art showing a scientific facts, so that through symbol, which is what art is, and teaching us all about that. So we have all these kids out there, this is just an aside, but we have all these kids out there that have grown up on those movies, and they already recognize this as truth, all right? So anyway, Paul Stamets actually is revolutionary in what he found out, that even though we may know this as truth intuitionally, and we may know this as truth through being fed this concept through the media that we've had, through cartoons and whatever, but Paul Stamets has done this research and figured it out. So, not only do they share nutrients, these neural networks that form between the roots share information as well as systemic, where you protect yourself, a systemic survival system for their immunity. And he found that out through science and measuring, and was able to discover that if you touched, like if you, for example, put some kind of aphids on one plant, even though these four plants were planted separately, that the plant that has the aphids sends out its resistance to aphids, like in some kind of chemical reaction in the plant. And then before the aphids even go to the other plants are expressing the same exact immunity. So it's showing that through the root system that there's a communication going on, and perhaps the mushroom, you know, helps facilitate these communications. So we've talked on this show before about how honeybees have they like to feed their babies a fermented pollen packets. They call it pap, and a lot of people call it bee bread, and or baby food is kind of, we end up calling it that, baby food. When you eat it, it sort of tastes like, you know, really smushy Flintstones vitamins. Baby food does, or the baby pap in the beehive just really tastes like that. Tastes like chewed up, yummy multivitamins. And it's a wonderful substance to try in the hive. It's different than the pollen that they're collecting on their pollen packs, which is what you find in the co-op in the jars where they're selling pollen. That pollen is collected by pollen traps to put on the entrance of the hive and pull off the little packets off their corbicula, sometimes doing damage to the bee. Just keep that in mind. And it's basically solely plant-based pollen. So it's if you're taking bee pollen for something other than maybe like a little bit of a, at the College of the Melissa, we take it as a sacrament, but you may be taking it as a, you know, something to boost your immune system, or, you know, you really like it for the little power burst, or maybe you just like it because it connects to the bee. It is just purely plant pollen. But the baby food in the hive is when they collect that pollen off their sister bees as they come in, bring it to the nurse bees or the baby bees in the hive, who have the cleanest, most beautiful immune systems in the hive, and they chew that pollen up. Add a little bit of royal jelly that comes from a gland inside the head. This gland is only activated in the young bees, and it produces royal jelly, which feeds the eggs and a small larva of the hive, as well as feeds the queen bee for her entire life. So they add this royal jelly to the baby food, or the pollen, to make it into baby food, and it begins a process of fermenting. Just like kefir or jun or kimchi or something, it creates this food that is actually more digestible and better assimilatable, and has added probiotic additives to it that form naturally, and we can only assume what is needed for the creatures of this bioregion. But guess what needs to be in that pap for it to fully break down? Pollen, as you know, is real sticky. That's what enables it to stick to the little hairs of the bee and help assist in pollination, as it likes to stick. It's something like a little Velcro. Most pollen has real spiky edges around the entire germ, and inside of that little spore is the food, that the protein that the baby bees need for healthy development. Well, it doesn't just break down by itself. It is assisted in its breakdown by application of this little microscopic fungus that grows in the hairs of the baby bees. So when the bees are cutely chewing up and packing their little baby food packs into those cells right around the brood, and the whole thing is smelling like baking bread or like a baby's head, and everything's just going right along, and those little larvas are so cute and white and snowy and moist and just curled up in there, little babies being fed by their sisters, and it smells just divine. Well, that little bit of fungus that comes from that little baby bee's head gets packed right along into those cells inadvertently and further breaks down the shell of the pollen particle and makes it assimilatable by these soft little soft creatures who are still developing their stomachs and digestive systems. So fungus is absolutely necessary as a part of bee survival, just from that fact alone. Well, let's take it back to Paul. So Paul Stamets is working on all of this mushroom goodness, and he's been doing it for many, many years. Like I said, I remember him way back in the day when I was living up in the Puget Sound. And he has this little synchronistic set of events where he's starting to read about fungicides having a horrible effect on bees, starts reading about this information about fungus being necessary to break down bee bread, and then he makes this discovery that his mushrooms that he's studying actually have absolutely insane, out of this world, off the charts ability to fight certain viruses like herpes simplex and the bird flu. And apparently is the most effective thing on the market. How amazing, you know? How totally amazing. And that the bees' medicine in the hives can also do that as well. For example, propolis is also really, really good at isolating viruses and harming the viruses without harming the host. That's the same thing with mushrooms. It is not toxic. These mushrooms that he's studying are not toxic to humans, but they're toxic to viruses. Well, I'm going to jump. Okay, it's still going to be all about Paul, but I want to jump back into what my fascination with is with bees and the ancient history of bees in medicine and bees in cultural transformation. I've mentioned before on the show, but I'm kind of bringing it full circle here, is Graham Hancock at the Synchronicity conference that I was fortunate enough to present at last spring in Joshua Tree. He talked about psychedelics in particular, mushrooms in particular, possibly, having a great effect on the transformation of culture, that at certain points in cultural history, human beings started utilizing these kinds of, fantastic, transformative, visionary plant medicines in ceremony and in shamanic experience. And so teachers were taking these medicines in order to meet up with their spirit guides and find out things that the culture need to know. And Graham Hancock felt that the two big times when that happened were, one, when we had a huge tool revolution many, many, many thousands of years ago, and we went from basic tools to far more complicated tools at the same time that we're starting to bury people and think about afterlife. And before that, when the tools were a little more simple, people were not being buried. They were just left where they died, like any old thing that would be dead in the forest. You would just leave it there and let nature take care of it. And then at the certain point, not only is there a huge tool revolution, there's also this huge revolution in how to interact with unseen realms by burial practices. And then he says that the second big revolution based on hallucinogens also comes at a time when myths tell us that the bees are bringing people to certain medicines, and huge cultural parties like Burning Man were done back in, this is, you know, an early history, but there are parties something like Burning Man where people would come to these areas and have huge festivals, and a town of 5,000 might swell to a town of 30,000 in these ancient times. They would be led through community ceremony by high priestesses such as the bee priestesses of ancient Greece. And also there's Egyptian versions and there's Japanese versions and there's all kinds of European versions of this same sort of thing happening, where bee priestesses would take people through underworld journeys and amazing things would come out of it, like Sophocles, Plato, Aristotle, all went through these ceremonies and became, maybe coincidentally, maybe due to the nature of these highly, probably highly stylized, highly professional ancient priestess practices in these temple, basically temple universities that they had. These places were the center of medicine, and it was said over and over and over and over and over again that the bees are bringing this medicine to the people. And they're also doing the most hallucinogenics of these medicines in high and important ceremony. And we are seeing things come out of these cultures, such as democracy and other great revolutionary cultural principles. Backtracking, I'm saying that Paul Stamets has tapped into the same information. The bees brought him to an awareness that the world needs right now. And that awareness that we need is an ability to understand the global immune system, the interaction between the human and the global immune system, and guess who's teaching that to us? The honeybee. The honeybee just took a leap and went and visited this mushroom guy and taught this mushroom guy something which is now being recognized on world scale as some of the most revelatory information to assist in bee health. And so dude is making a mycological honey that they're feeding to the bees, and they're finding reduced viral loads and increased longevity in the bee life. And his thesis, or his theory, is that we will see reductions in varroa mites and an increase in colony survival. I'm all for it. I'm sold. Send me the kit, brother. I want to make that mat in my forest. I want to lay a bark field down that has a beautiful prayer flag all around it that says, this may look like a rotting pile of sawdust to you, but guess what? It's mycological support for the immune system for my precious little angel honeybees. I think that is absolutely fascinating. So I really encourage you, if you're interested in this, to look it up. And maybe you're out there and you're a fun guy, and you have the ability or knowledge, and you want to work with me on creating mushroom forage for our bees, you just, let's hook up. I would love to meet you. I would love to talk about you. You can write me at lauraFergusonABC@gmail.com. Or if you didn't get your pencil in time, you can look up College of the Melissae, M-E-L-I-S-S-A-E. Find me that way. Or, of course, you can write this station at kskq.org. So that is just something we got to do something about, you guys. This is the year of experimentation for the College of the Melissae. We're going to be working with top bar hives. We're going to have a weekly summer drop-in bee field days. And we're going to do sacred beekeeping, natural, intuitive, treatment-free beekeeping. We're going to work together at creating gorgeous forage for our delightful honeybees. And we're going to be working a lot on making videos for the world to see that this is a real way to take care of honeybees. It's real. It's good. It feels good. It looks good. It sounds good. The bees love it. I love it. And I bet the world will love it too. And so if you want to be involved in that, you can write me a letter as well. I'll probably try to make some announcements weekly about that. It's a drop-in class, $15 drop-in, and $10 if you want to join for the summer. You can pay $10 a class. So anyway, that's some real exciting stuff here in our local environment. This guy, this mycologist, Paul Stamets, would love to have him at one of the sacred beekeeping conferences that I'm working on, and especially because this guy sees it for real. He sees it from the ground into the potential rather than trying to find a way to recreate the holy dollar. But many blessings on his abundance. He deserves it for being an absolute genius. So recently I got a letter about a friend of mine who lives in the Bay Area. And she sent me a letter and she said, you know what? I have maybe 20 bees in my hive with a queen. And I didn't tell her at the time, but I knew what it was. The reason why I didn't tell her at the time was because she was just really wanting to rescue the hive. And when it gets down to that point, what we're dealing with is actually colony collapse disorder. And I've been seeing it around here. And, you know, it's one of those scary things that sounds really, really bad and really, really big. And it is. It definitely is. But what it's really representing, colony collapse disorder, is basically like saying acquired immune deficiency syndrome or AIDS. It is a failure of an immune system. The difficulty with working with the beehive and their immune system is they have a socialized immune system. It's a BN, meaning it's a superorganism, meaning that every single member of that team needs to be there for the entire being to survive. It's a superorganism. So you can measure individual immune response, but that's not going to give you the whole picture of the superorganism of the bee. But guess what, brothers and sisters? The bee is not just a super organism in and of herself. She is actually a vital member of an immune system of that entire bioregion. So, when, for example, the bees working with the mushrooms, if the bees are failing because the mushroom net is missing, then that is not necessarily a sign of their immune system. Here's a point about that. Paul Stamets said, I just love that article. It just blew my mind. Paul Stamets says, okay, most, let me see if I can get this right. You'll see it and you'll be able to review it. But what I want to say is, because I'm a metaphorical speaker. I'm a metaphorical thinker. I'm a poet before I'm a scientist. But the science informs my metaphor and informs my poetry. So, of course, I see these things in a broad stroke, like, whoa, possibility, rainbow possibility, rather than the actual details, which is something maybe I need to work on, but I don't know. Who cares? And the but what I want to say about that is that the bee is has this, okay, the mushroom brings up these certain chemicals that are needed in the body for a healthy immune system. And human beings and other animals naturally have about 80 of these already in our system or able to handle it in the system. Well, the bee only has something like 37. So they need to find these substances in nature in order to develop a healthy immune system. And some of these substances are available through the fungal net. So in other words, their immune system is not based on what their immune system does per se by themselves. Their immune system is dependent upon the immune system of the planet. They need the mushroom net in order to fully express their healthy immune system. So when we're talking about the superorganism of the bee and studying the superorganism of the bee, you cannot exclude their direct relationship with the environment. They are a superorganism within the environment. And the reason why I say they're a superorganism within the environment is because the environment cannot survive without the pollinators. The environment goes down. The environment ceases to thrive when the pollinators cease to thrive. So the missing fungal net will affect the not only honeybees, of course, because honeybees are European, not native to the Americas or any other continent, you know, besides the African, European. I'm not sure where all the native species are of the Apis mellifera, but I do know that they're not native to the Americas, this whole continent from AK on down. So but the native bees are going to, the native pollinators and insects and bugs of all kinds, including, you know, the mitochondrial level of organisms, these tiny little creatures that are microscopic that live in the soil, they are also probably have a dependency on these nets for their immune system. The planet is expressing the fungal net as an immune system. And by applying pesticides and destroying forests, we are killing the natural immune system of the planet. So if that immune system goes down and the pollinators go down and the pollinators aren't able to get to the flowers to help express the fruit and seed of the flower in that beautiful love affair that we talked about at the start of the show, then the immune system of that plant and the fertility system of that plant goes down. The immune system will go down because if, like Paul Stamets discovered, you have four plants in conjunction that are sitting right next to each other and the bee only gets to pollinate one of them, then eventually you're going to have pockets where there's no pollinated foods. Therefore, plants will start growing in isolation and not be able to communicate through that root network and the fungal network in the soil. Wow, that felt really good. Expressing that and explaining that and learning that feels like one of those keys. You know, it feels like one of those things that needs to be talked about, needs to be excited for people. People need to understand that when we're talking about environmental rescue, we're not talking about just one spotted owl, for goodness sakes. We're talking about a planetary system. And these wildlands in particular need to be preserved because there's an incredible wealth of not only resources for ongoing life, but also potentials for incredible medicines that could possibly really help not only humans, but the honeybee. So colony collapse. So my friend comes up with, you know, this picture of her beehives, and she's going to try to save him. I don't know how she's going to try to save him, but you know, that was her goal. And sweetheart, I mean, that's just normal. That's normal. The sensitive beekeeper will want to try and save it. But a beekeeper that's a little more experienced might recognize that that is indeed colony collapse disorder. And colony collapse disorder, and let me just give you a definition here, because there's a lot of talk about it without people really understanding what it is, right? And according to the USDA.gov site, the main symptom of CCD is very low or no adult honeybees present in the hive, but with a live queen and no dead honeybee bodies present. Often there is still honey in the hive and immature bees or brood are present. Varroa mites, a virus-transmitting parasite of honeybees, have frequently been found in hives hit by CCD. This isn't the first time we've had CCD in the United States. It happened in the 1800s, in the 1920s, and in the 1960s. And the descriptions were similar, but we don't know what the agents were that caused those because we didn't have the scientific autopsies that we can do on hives today. But it has hit hugely here and is actually so incredibly pervasive that beekeepers have been reporting losses between 30 to 90% of their hives since October 2006. Also, during that time, not only were 30 to 90% of managed colonies failing, about 90% of feral colonies also failed. And that is like 80% more, I guess. Actually, that would be like, anyway, normally it's 10% a loss. Like nature, you can expect 10% a loss to bears, disease, cold, starvation, wind, whatever. You can experience 10% loss as an average back in the day. In fact, if your hives got low, you didn't have enough bees for some reason, like a bear came in and knocked them all over, all you had to do was go out to the forest and fetch them. You didn't even have to buy them. You could just go get them. In fact, bee breeding wasn't really done until about less than 100 years ago. People didn't have commercial bee sales. You bought them from your regional beekeeper when he was ready, and it was most likely a he, when he was ready to split his hive or create nucleus colonies for you. Or you could go get them in the forest. That was it. You didn't buy them from somebody that mass produced 10 bazillion of them in the typical factory farming way of doing it. So when you're out there buying your bees, and I know some of you are thinking about buying your bees and you're wanting to know where to buy them, you guys, let's just stick local. John Jacobs and this other guy, I'll try to get his name. I think his name is Nathan. There's a couple queen breeders in our area. Unfortunately, they do go to the almonds to pump up their brood. You will probably be getting some kind of level of toxicity in the nucleus hive you get. But that being said, they're the best around, okay? They're doing the best they can. They're ethical, loving beekeepers doing the very best they can to take care of their bees in a transitioning industry. They also will make that transition. Eric at Dig and Livin', I don't know if he's selling bees, but Eric and John are great ethical beekeepers. They love their bees. They are very connected to them on a spiritual level. And they're doing what they're doing to try to rescue our relationship with bees just as much as I or any other beekeeper is doing once we commit ourselves to this. So if you're going to buy bees, Old Soul Apiaries, I'll get you the other name of another guy. And Eric at Dig and Livin', he may have bees. And if you're going to buy bees from out of the area, which is not a bad idea, try to look for bees that are, have varroa sensitive hygiene, that have treatment free colonies, and hopefully not they or the comb has gone to the almond industry. So that's an aside, because colony collapse. Now, why do they say, let me read that again. The main symptom of CCD is very low or no adult honeybees present in the hive, but with a live queen and no dead honeybee bodies present. Okay, if you had that configuration of a queen and some adult bees with a little bit of brood and then a whole bunch of dead ones on the bottom, that's going to be a freeze die-off or a pesticide die-off. But what this is talking about, this is most likely an expression of a socialized immune system where the bees are starting to die, and as a part of their socialized immune system, they don't go back in the home because they don't want to bring the disease of whatever they're dying from back in the home. They also don't want to create extra work for their sister bees. If they go die in the home, somebody's got to spend time trying to drag them out and fly them away. So they just die outside the hive. They're not putting the risk of their parasite or pathogens or virus loads coming back into the hive, because remember, the beehive is the brain and the womb and a sterile environment of the living organism, of the superorganism of the honeybee. So this colony collapse disorder actually could be a synergistic expression of failure, or an expression of failure due to the synergistic overlay of pesticides and fungicides and so forth. It could even be nutritional deficiencies caused over long term in the beehive that creates neural and developmental problems in the bee. Perhaps neurologically, they are not as strong as they were a while ago because of monocropping and singular forage. Just like if all you ate every dang day was carrots, pretty soon you're gonna be a funny color and you're not gonna be able to, you know, you're gonna not have enough protein, you're not gonna have enough fats, your body's gonna waste away, it's gonna make decision-making problems, you might lose too much weight, and, you know, that might be what happens if you only ate carrots, you're not a rabbit. So, you know, that's the same with the bees. If they only eat certain elements, for example, almond nectar for their entire lifespan, that's all they're eating, well, and that's all they're feeding the babies, well, try feeding, you know, apple juice. Apple juice isn't bad for you, but if that's all your baby ate, your baby is not going to get the certain things needed for the immune system, for brain development, for organ development, for even for the ability to communicate or socialize might be affected by the things they're eating, and especially not these probiotics and these funguses. The main problem with the almond industry, like we talked about for the last 2 weeks, where 60 or 70% of the world or the country's bees go to, they are, their main issue with those almond blossoms is, guess what? Fungus. So they're actually spraying fungicides in these plants. So microscopic fungicides are getting into the microscopic little bellies of these tiny little creatures who have no defense against pesticides, nothing built into them to help their little systems release those toxins from their system. It goes in through their bodies and begins stages of immune system failures that this undoubtedly plays a part. But guess what? Mushrooms can help clear toxins. So perhaps mushrooms can be used in connection with pesticide awareness. It's not a smart idea to think that mushrooms can fix pesticide issues, but as we're transitioning into a pesticide-free world, we can use mushrooms perhaps to help cleanse and heal our baby's immune systems of the toxins of pesticides and other pollutants in our water, air, and soil. Ah, that sounds so good. Actually sounds like the smartest thing I've heard in terms of medicines for the bees. Doesn't it? Sounds so much better than taking a chemical and applying it to a hive, especially since the bees are asking for it. They're actually going to the mushroom mats, eating of the mushrooms. They're going to the trees, eating of the propolis and bringing that medicine back, why not help assist by finding the best products out there from nature and promoting that kind of environment for our bees? Now, I'm not talking about just feeding them mushrooms. I'm talking about creating mushroom beds for them to have, creating forage. Ethical beekeepers create forage. It's less about what you put in the hive than what about you put around the hive. And gardening and beekeeping go hand in hand. And I think it would probably be a great marriage if a gardener married a beekeeper, because that would really be super helpful to beekeepers and really helpful to gardeners. So that's really good marriage material. But in terms of marriage and community, garden clubs and bee clubs should go hand in hand, just like the Bee City Ashland in their ultimate genius and brilliance gave Bee City Ashland to the Parks Department. So the Parks Department is now making sure that Bee City Ashland is implemented here in our little town. So what a great civic concept there. Thank you, thank you, thank you. That was really smart. Really love that. And that makes me proud of Ashland. Only have a couple minutes left, so I want to take it just one step further into something kind of totally off this topic, but back on healthier colonies. And I'm going to read it, and it's an article by a guy named Derek Mead, which I think is awesome. He's got a mead is, of course, a honey wine, and this guy's writing about bees. And guess what? And he's a redhead, which is another bonus point. But guess what his title's called? It's Promiscuous Queen Bees and Probiotics Create Healthier Colonies. So I thought that was cool. Promiscuous Queen Bees, promoting promiscuity in the queen bee. I think that's just awesome as a understanding of how queen bees work. They mate with 10 to 20 drones on the wing, maybe once or twice in their life. And so this article is going to talk about that. So let's talk about why would promiscuity in a queen bee positively affect colony survival. This article is written March 12, 2012 by Derek Mead. And it's on a webpage called motherboard.vice.com. It's a blog. Honeybees have been a hot topic of research ever since the discovery that they were dying in droves, blah, blah, colony collapse disorder, blah, blah. Statistics. More statistics, 400 crop species, $15 billion a year of work in the U.S. for pollinators, blah, blah, blah. That makes sorting out what makes bees tick a research priority. Heather Matila, a bee ecologist at Wellesley College, and Irene Newton, a microbiologist at Indiana University, just published research in PLOS One looking at how bee diversity affects overall health. Their team found that more promiscuous queens, ones that made it with multiple males before setting up their colony, produced offspring with a far superior ratio of good to bad bacteria in their stomachs as compared to their single male counterparts. Okay, single male counterparts would probably be ones that are artificially inseminated, okay? So the way that they, because when you're artificially inseminated, you're just pulling drone sperm, like probably with some kind of draconian big needle, and then some big, huge, ugly forceps that has to open up, you know what, of the queen bee, and then they stick the needle in there, and they put the sperm in there, and it's really gross and horrible and mean, and looks like something out of the evil Middle Ages. So anyway, that's what artificial insemination looks like to me. It makes me want to puke. So anyway, the team compared two groups of honeybee colonies. One group was made up of genetically diverse populations produced by queens that had been inseminated by at least 15 different males. The other group was genetically similar, but each queen only mated a single male. And they found that the diverse colonies contained an average total of 1,105 species of bacteria inside the bees, while the genetically uniform populations were host to an average of 781 bacteria species. That might sound bad for the diverse bees, but it's not. The diverse populations were host to 40% more beneficial bacteria, while the uniform population had 127% pathogen, despite having fewer bacteria species overall. Those data have one takeaway. More diverse bee populations were host to more diverse and more beneficial bacteria populations than their genetically uniform counterparts, which were actually host to more dangerous bacteria. In other words, more diverse bee populations are healthier, especially considering some of the bacteria limited those populations were the same kind of digestion-aiding species that we humans use as so-called probiotics. Now, if it seems obvious that a more genetic diversity would lead to better health, especially in the single female colonies of the Hymenoptera, it's because it is. Researchers have known that fact for quite some time, but the mechanics have long been opaque. This study sheds some light on the equation, showing that diverse honeybee populations, at the very least, are more likely to take advantage of probiotic bacteria. Building a good base of knowledge about bee health is key to developing strategies to protect colonies and blah, blah, blah. So, so more probiotics for bees that get around. So here's to the queen bee getting her groove on the wing. Let's hope there's a lot of healthy treatment-free bees out there because the drones are more likely to be able to mate and spread these healthy qualities if they haven't been treated. It's scientific fact that treated bees have lower sperm counts and lower fertility levels for the queen. So let's re-up that commitment to try to go treatment-free this year. Going to have a bee club. We're going to go to lots of different apiaries, have field trips. It'll be really fun. And we'll talk about how to go treatment-free. So if you want to take the risk, you want to be a part of the transition team, show the rest of the world how it's done, let's try and figure that out together. So thanks for listening to another hour of Honey Culture Radio. It's been my joy to share bee stories with you. Look up Paul Stamets. Give me a ring if you want some bee classes. And let's talk at you next week. It's been a beautiful day. The bees are out there buzzing. Life is coming back to the planet. The world is going on. We have emerged out of darkness. We are in the light again. Blessings to all of you people out there that love the bees and love honey and love the sweet things in life. And blessings to all of you, especially the activists, the warriors, the farmers. The farmers are the warriors, and thank you for all the work you're doing. Many blessings upon you all, and we'll talk at you next week. Honey Culture Radio.